Do you have any other comments to make regarding the grounding and the events that happened shortly thereafter before I switch to another topic?
No, I sure don't. I think that covers it.
I just have one question regarding the overtime of unlicensed personnel. Okay. Is it true that as chief officer, you signed the overtime for the unlicensed deck personnel?
That's correct.
Excluding weekends and penalty time,
okay,
what is the average overtime hours per AB per month?
Normally, they would work about 4 hours a day. Okay. It depends on the AB. I have ABs that don't work any overtime at all. I have ABs that are hungry for money. Them I will not allow to work like on Sunday or something. So you could conceivably have an AB who works, let's say, 4 hours a day, 5 days, let's say 6 days a week. And so that would be 24 hours overtime a week. Multiply that by four, and that'll give you non-operational type overtime. Okay, so then you can take that as maintenance overtime, and operational overtime will vary on the trade and the run where we are. 1 month we may only be in Valdez, so that's one port call. The next pay period we could conceivably be in San Francisco lightering for, let's say, a week or so, and we have lightering ships coming and going, so there would be a lot of operational overtime.
Would the 4 to 8 AB make significantly more overtime than an 8 to 12 or the 12 to 4?
He or she has the ability to do that, because conceivably they could work 8 hours every day for overtime.
So that would be how many hours per week and how many hours per month?
8 hours a day, multiply that by 30, and that's your number. I mean, that would be maintenance overtime.
Now, on your watch, Body Exxon Valdez, your ABs work the maximum amount of overtime?
Some of them do, some of them don't.
So one additional question. Maureen Jones stated that she heard the bullets, lift. Do you have any comments to make about that?
Well, I've heard this from a number of people, and I think Mr. Woody was the one that asked me that at the informal interview. It is my opinion that the bullets did not lift. Most people in the maritime field would hear bullets lift. Very few would hear the vacuum side go. When I was a Coast Guard inspector, I got to hear vacuum sides go for inspection. It sounds very similar to a bullet lifting. With the cargo going out, the vacuum's going to go, not the bullet. The bullet goes via pressure. I find it very difficult to conceive that the tanks became overpressurized with the cargo running out at perhaps 200,000 to 300,000 barrels an hour.
Thank you, Mr. Kunkel. I don't have any further questions.
Okay.
Mr. Sager.
Mr. Kunkel.
Yes, sir.
What is your average work day in length?
That would depend on the vessel's position. At sea, I normally would stand the 48 watch. That would be 0400 to 0800, 1600 to 2000. And I would normally try to work, or I would have to work usually anywhere from 4.
You're listening to live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board inquiry into the grounding and wreck of the Exxon Valdez from KSK Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Right now, the witness on the stand is James R. Kunkel, the chief mate of the Exxon Valdez. He's being questioned by Eric Sager, who is the human performance specialist from the National Transportation Safety Board.
After watch, when I get off at 2000, I usually try to get to bed no later than 2100 to 2200, because I'll be called at 0330 the next morning. And that's at sea. In port, it pretty much is, it's dependent on the operation of what we're doing in port.
Are you frequently up 24-hour stretches?
Yes. However, very seldom have I been on my feet for a full 24-hour period. There's always an hour or an hour and a half where I can sit in my chair.
Is this customary for chief mates on these?
Well, it's been my knowledge that on a three-mate ship, this does happen. Sometimes it would vary on the chief mate also. In other words, you may have a chief mate that is confident with his people or doesn't feel he has to be around. Myself, I have a lot of confidence in my officers, so what I normally try to do is be there maybe when their watch starts, make sure that everything is going well, and then I get out of their hair and let them run the show. Maybe towards the end of their watch or when the new watch is coming, be available.
Do you earn overtime for this?
No, I don't. Not per se. I don't keep track of overtime. I'm a salaried employee.
Do you do evaluations of crew members?
Yes, I do.
Among the ABs, have you done evaluations of able-bodied seamen?
Of ABs?
Yes.
I don't quite understand your question, sir.
Have you done personnel evaluations on an Exxon vessel for persons serving as able-bodied seamen?
Oh, numerous.
What are some of the attributes that are highly valued by Exxon?
A good safety awareness, a good quality in their work. In other words, if I assign them a job, they get it done. People who can work with a minimal amount of supervision. Let's see.
Willingness to work overtime?
Well, you know, that's really not a criteria that I use. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't people who may use that as their criteria, but I never use that. I feel that as long as the person is doing his required work, overtime is their option unless I have something that has to be done. But I have never used overtime as a basis as to whether the employee's performance is better or worse. But as I said, I'm sure there are people who do.
While you've been working on these Exxon tankers, have you experienced fatigue sufficient fatigue that you had concerns about your own performance?
To this date, I've never felt that I was in a position where I couldn't perform my duties. I guess I just try to take care of myself and one way or the other make the time to take a break.
Have you ever had any training from Exxon or any specific instructions regarding how to regulate yourself to minimize fatigue or how to recognize fatigue in the persons you supervise?
Well, I know that there are some instructional tapes aboard the vessel that are available. I know that I've been to conferences, senior officer conferences, and short time management type courses were made available. I recall attending one, or actually it was part of one. But as far as a formal come in and close yourself off from the rest of the world and be instructed on time management, no, I can't recall ever having that done.
How about recognizing symptoms of fatigue?
You mean, has somebody told me how to recognize whether I'm fatigued or not? No one has ever told me that. No. However, I have found that most of the captains in Exxon, including Mr. Hazelwood, are more than happy to tell the chief mate to get off his feet and they'll take the watch or something like that. That I have seen on a number of occasions.
Have you heard complaints from other officers about their being fatigued?
Well, you know, they say if a seaman isn't bitching, he ain't happy. So, you know, I don't really know how you want me to answer that question. Have I ever felt that officers were...
Well, let me interrupt you for a moment.
Okay.
The reason I'm asking these questions is because there's been a great deal of interest in fatigue and safety on reduced crew vessels. And it is of enough interest that the Coast Guard is funding two major studies that deal specifically with fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So while I'm asking you these questions, I'm really asking you for some very serious observations on these reduced crew vessels that you're serving.
Okay. I understand that this is a very serious matter and that this board of inquiry is very serious. I don't want to give you any impression that I'm taking anything lightly. I would say that the only way to study this would be to have experts come aboard these demanned vessels and perhaps let the people know. You're talking to a person who is just used to this. This is normal to me. If you want me to make an observation as to what would be different, I can't tell you, because this is the way I've come up with my career, and this is normal. And it's the only thing I have to base on, that if you want to be the chief mate, this is how you will work. If you want to be a second mate or a third mate, this is how you will work. If you want to be a captain, this is what's expected of you. It's the only thing I have to base my assumptions on.
Have you ever heard Mr. Cousins complain of being fatigued?
No, I have never heard that. Of course, I was only with Mr. Cousins since I joined the vessel on the 8th of March. And as a matter of fact, I found Mr. Cousins to be very helpful, very interested in the vessel operation. He did a real good job on respirators. He felt that they should be a different system on board, and I let him go at it. But I've never heard him complain of not getting enough sleep.
Have you ever seen him tired?
Not that I can recall.
Would you like to have the third mate back working for you?
Obviously, yes. You mean a four-mate ship? Is that what you're...
No, would you like the third mate, Mr. Cousins, back?
Oh, yes, of course. Based on what I've seen, I find him to be a very competent young man. Based on the testimony that he gave, which I saw part of it yesterday, I was very impressed by the fact that I thought he was a real solid citizen, a good man, and that he did the best that he could. And obviously, the ship went on the ground, so somebody made an error.
A couple of questions about the master after the accident.
Okay.
In your opinion, from your contact with him, direct contact with him, and what you had overheard, do you feel he was responsive to the emergency?
Yes, I do.
Who was clearly in charge of the vessel?
The master. This is after the grounding?
After the grounding.
Yes, sir.
Did you ever have any concerns about his competence to continue in command?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I was somewhat disappointed when he left the vessel. No reflection on the new captains that came aboard, but I was disappointed that he would not be around to direct the operation.
That's all I have. Thank you.
All right, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Sager. Dr. Berkey?
Yes, I have a couple of questions. What do you understand the Exxon Shipping Company policy to be on alcohol and drugs among its employees?
Okay. It is my understanding of the policy, from what I have read, that the use and the possession aboard Exxon vessels would be an offense that demands disciplinary action. And the current policy would be termination.
How is this policy enforced?
I'm not quite sure at what you mean by how is it enforced.
How is it implemented?
All right. It was put out in writing. At conferences, senior officer conferences, we were instructed of what the policy was. And it is my understanding that it is the master's job and the officer's jobs to see that the policy is followed.
Have you ever had occasion to call attention to that policy to anyone aboard a vessel you served on with an Exxon vessel?
No, I sure haven't.
Did you at any time see drinking on the vessel or any vessel you served on, an Exxon vessel?
Well, I've never seen it, but I know I've been going to sea now for a while, and alcohol is around, and I don't remember the occasions or what, but I've been on ships before, not just with Exxon, that I never saw it. I was never directly involved with it, but I can assume there was alcohol.
Have you ever been invited to have a drink with Captain Hazelwood on the vessel?
Not that I recall. No.
Have you looked at Exhibit 6J, an interview, give a summary by the radio operator?
Yes. Wait one sec.
Sure.
He has the exhibit.
Pardon me?
The witness has the exhibit.
Okay. If you look at the, on the first page of that exhibit, the bottom paragraph, where the radio operator, Mr. Robertson, who this was his first trip on the vessel, was invited to have a drink with Captain Hazelwood. Is it? Are you aware of that?
I've got the wrong one here.
6J?
It says 6I.
The witness on the stand right now is the first mate, James R. Kunkel, who's reviewing a transcript of an interview with the ship's radio officer in which he alleged that he was invited to have a drink with Captain Joseph Hazelwood.
And that he had been invited, apparently, to participate in drinking aboard the vessel.
No, I did not know this.
You have never been invited to have a drink with Captain Hazelwood?
Not to my knowledge, no. I spent most of my time learning the ship, and I don't do too much socializing on board the vessel. It's just not my style.
Did you at any time ever question the decisions that were made by Captain Hazelwood when you served under him? For any reason whatsoever?
No, sir, never did.
You never had any doubts after the grounding that decisions may have been made incorrectly? Or you questioned them?
No, I don't recall any decisions that I had a doubt about, no. Apparently what he did and what we did was the right thing, because the ship didn't sink. Nobody got hurt. It stayed there. So I'm assuming that if I had to do it all over again, I would do it exactly the same way.
And those decisions were all made by Captain Hazelwood?
Most decisions were, yes.
With information you provided?
Most of it was, I provided him stability data and stuff like that. That's correct.
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Berkey. Mr. Hallett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kunkel, you stated that you suggested that a naval architect be brought in to make a recommendation or a plan prior to pumping the port side?
That's correct.
And was that done?
It's my understanding, yes, it was.
Do you know when his recommendations were received in relation to the grounding?
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. It's the exact time.
Well, could you describe to me how that affected the timing of the lightering operation?
At my level, I really wasn't aware of how if that affected the timing or not. As far as I know, we brought the Baton Rouge alongside very shortly, and it just came alongside, and we tied it up, and we started lightering as soon as we had the equipment available.
All right, thank you. Have you been ashore in Valdez?
Yes, I have.
And did you return to the terminal via taxi?
No, the only time I've been ashore in Valdez is when they flew me in there to have the NTSB hearing.
So you've never returned through the front gate of the terminal?
No, I've never been ashore in Valdez. As far as leaving a ship, no. I've never left a ship and gone ashore.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Commander Waldron?
Morning, Chief Bate. First of all, I'd like to thank you publicly for your part in the saving of the 40 million gallons of crude that was left on the vessel. That your effort and your assistance to the Coast Guard prevented a much worse disaster, and I'd like to thank you for that.
Thank you.
During this questioning, I'm going to be referring to two documents. One is for Oscar, which is the operations manual, the vessel operations manual. And the other one is to Echo.
Testimony is now moving to the other spokespeople for the other interests here at the hearing. Right now, it's Coast Guard Commander William Waldron, who has referred Chief Mate Kunkel to two exhibits. One is the operations manual for the vessel, and the other is that course recorder that shows what actual courses the vessel was on that night.
General questions about vessel equipment. We talked about the fathom alarm and whether it was set and what setting it was on. Apparently, we've not been able to determine that. But would you explain how the fathom alarm works?
It's my understanding that you set the alarm and that if the vessel, the depth of the water gets less than that, the alarm will go off.
Okay, where is the fathometer located on this vessel, the transducer?
It's on the bow, I believe, under the forepeak.
Okay, thank you. On the steering system, this vessel apparently has an off-course alarm. Could you explain what an off-course alarm is and how it works?
You mean as if you were in gyro and you came off course, or do you mean at the helm and the rudder do not match?
Well, if the helm and rudder do not match, what happens?
Okay. If you operate the helm and the rudder does not respond, I believe it is within 8 seconds or 10, somewhere in that area, on the after panel to your port side while you're operating the helm, it will make an alarm. It's a audible and a visual light goes on.
Okay, if I could repeat what you said here, if the helmsman turned to 10 degrees and the rudder did not follow within 8 to 10 or 12 seconds,
right,
whatever the criteria is, then an alarm would go off. Is that
yes.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
Would you go through, would the same thing happen when you're in gyro? If the vessel was in gyro and the helmsman turned 10 degrees and it was mm-hmm. still in gyro, what would happen then?
I'm not certain of that. To be quite honest with you, I'd have to consult with the manual. I'm not certain whether it would go off or not. I do know that there is an off-reference heading alarm when you're in the gyro mode. As to whether you will turn the helm When in gyro, and that will go off. I am not certain of that.
Okay. Is it? Are these alarms checked prior to getting underway?
Some of them would be. The off helm is very. It would be checked. I personally have never checked the gyro, and the wheel being operated, because you have no effect on the gyro. If you operate the wheel when you're in gyro, you don't do anything.
You stated that you rechecked the steering system.
Mm-hmm. I swung it both ways, made sure that the rudder was responding to the helm. That's what I mean by checking it.
Okay. Is there any way to check the to see if the alarm is working?
You could turn off the steering system and then do it. Because anytime you move that wheel, the rudder will respond.
Okay. Did you check that system prior to getting underway to see if the alarm was functioning properly?
No, I personally did not. I didn't test the gear.
Where else does the alarm sound besides the wheelhouse?
There's an alarm in the engine room, to my understanding, of a steering failure or problem.
Thank you. The next line of questioning is going to be concerning the standard operating procedures on this vessel and other Exxon vessels. Most of those are found in 4 Oscar, the exhibit before you. The first line of questioning is the type of watch that should have been or was being stood as a vessel left the port of Valdez. This is on pages 61 and 64. I'm sorry, my mistake. It's pages 58, top of the page. There are 4 watch types, watch A, B, C, and D. Which watch type would you describe as being applicable for this journey out of into Prince William Sound?
All right. Under normal conditions, of course, the master would set the watch condition. That's his responsibility. So you're asking me basically here to make a hypothetical judgment. Is that what you want? In other words, I do not have any idea what the watch condition was when it left the port.
No, I'd like to ask you which one of these watch types would describe the vessel departing. Which one would be applicable for a vessel departing?
It would appear to me that at least in the Valdez arm, you would be under watch condition C.
Okay. Would you read the requirements for watch condition C, please?
Okay. Supplementary personnel are necessary so that there are 2 officers on the bridge with a lookout posted. If the automatic pilot is being used, comply at all times with the requirements of Regulation 19 SOLIS, see page 55. In planning for compliance, take into account the need to station the helmsman and engage manual control and ample time to allow any potential hazardous situation to be dealt with in a safe manner. Normally, the officer complement will be the master and a watch officer, but may, in special circumstances, be the senior deck officer and the watch officer.
That's fine. Thank you. On the previous page, it said with a lookout posted. What does a lookout posted mean to you?
It would normally mean at the furthest point forward and as low as possible, i.e. the bow. However, there is conceivable to me that the lookout could be posted on the wing of the bridge due to weather.
During the certain periods in operation, it requires the AB that's on lookout to perform other duties other than lookout. For instance, at 11:20, 23:20 that evening, the pilot was being let off. Required assistance by more than one person, the third mate and the lookout were called from their positions of responsibility to the port side of the vessel to help the pilot off. What provisions are made for a lookout at that time?
I would assume that at that moment, at that incident in time, there would be no lookout based on what you have just described to me. The officer on the bridge would be performing lookout as well. I would assume that at that moment, at that incident in time, there would be no lookout based on what you have just described to me. The officer on the bridge would be performing lookout as well as the navigational duties.
Is this in compliance with the watch type C, where you have only the one watch officer and the helmsman on the bridge and no one else around in a restricted area?
It would appear to me that it's not.
Is there any provision made on other trips where you have, where you are navigating in and out of a port to call out off-watch ABs or officers to assist in the navigation of the vessel?
Yes, I have seen that done on occasions.
Would you explain under what circumstances and under what vessels?
Well, I know in the Panama Canal that's done quite often. And then if the conditions outside, were such that the master felt that that was necessary, I've seen that happen.
I have a question concerning some of the duties of lookout. Is there any directions generally given by you as a watch officer to your lookouts for any specific things that they should be looking for?
Well, normally whenever I take the watch, I'll have just a general discussion with them, what I expect of them. I want the lights reported. I want any traffic reported, any hazards that they may see. I ensure that they have an understanding of the point system. That would be the extent of the conversation.
In particular, when you're entering or leaving port, what particular directions do you give to a lookout? In other words, do you ask for them to report any certain lights or for them to expect to see something on the port or starboard side?
Yes, at times I would do that. I would tell them that, okay, we're coming up on, such and such a light, or I expect to see a light on the starboard bow. Let me know when you see it. Or there's a buoy ahead that I can't see on radar, or I don't see with the binoculars. If you see it, let me know. I think there's some small vessels in the area. Keep me posted, that kind of information.
Have you ever navigated a vessel where you expected to encounter ice?
No, I've never had that experience.
Would you consider ice as one of the hazards of navigation that you would be instructing your lookouts to look for?
Yes.
If you're entering an area where you expected to encounter ice, what precautions would you take with a lookout?
What do you mean by precautions, sir?
Would you instruct the lookout, and where would you post a lookout?
Well, I would probably give the, this is all hypothetical, I would give the lookout instructions that there was probably ice in the area. Weather permitting, safety of the vessel, I may post them forward. That wouldn't, in my opinion, totally hypothetical. It wouldn't negate putting the lookout on the wing of the bridge, though.
In the standing orders to the vessel, and this is page 94, appendix C to the guide. Paragraph 2 talks about a watch over officer taking over. Page 94, top of the page. Top of the page.
You're listening to live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board's inquiry into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. This is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Right now, the witness on the stand is the first mate of the Exxon Valdez, James R. Kunkel. He's being questioned by Commander William Waldron, representing the Coast Guard.
With the following, by personally checking and confirming various things. One of the things on the next page is navigational dangers or potential dangers the vessel's required to pass. What is Exxon and this company's policy, this vessel's policy, concerning closest point of approach to shoal areas or other natural hazards?
At sea, I believe it is 20 miles. Confined waters, I'm taking a stab here, I'd have to read it again, it's 5 miles. However, I want you to be aware that it would vary on the safe side from ship to ship. I've had masters that say you will not go closer than 25 or 30 miles. I've had, in other words, I have had masters that will go require more.
What is the Exxon and the ship's policy concerning leaving traffic lanes or other marked channels?
Well, it's my understanding that you are to be in the traffic lanes. That's not only required by Exxon, but that's required by the regulations. And if you depart from that for any reason, you must get permission to do so.
Would you explain the term alter course position?
Alter course position. I'd have to look that up.
Okay, I think it's on page 87.
Okay. All right, now I understand what you're talking about. In other words, that would be a position where it has been predetermined that you will change the course of the vessel.
What are the requirements for an ultra course position according to this manual?
I'm not quite sure what you want, Commander, okay. I'll be honest with you. Right. I mean, I can read this to you, but I'm sure everybody can read it. I'm not quite sure.
Basically, it says that the master determines a predetermined place to alter course. And I think that the general purpose behind this is an open sea type alter course position, but it may apply to this situation where there is a point where the master's determined that course change is to be made, and it requires him to do certain things primarily is to make a position to alter course, either a lat long or a position to make that change, an abeam position or whatever. Okay. So my question is, in the case of navigating in an area coming out of Prince William Sound, are there alter course positions?
Yes, there are. They are in the lane.
Okay. If you were to go outside of the lane, would there also be alter course position?
If you were to go outside the lane, it would be the watch officer's duty, or under the guidance of the master, of course, to predetermine some positions to alter course. In other words, you've now deviated from the track, and the alter course positions are no longer valid.
All right. Would a beam of a certain, say, Busby Island light, a beam of the light, would that be considered an alter course position?
Yeah, it could be. I would prefer to also get a distance. In other words, a beam, so many miles, a beam of such and such, alter course.
Also in the standing orders, there's a requirement for the position of a vessel to be frequently verified when in sight of land. Mm-hmm. Now, what does in sight of land mean, and what is meant by frequently?
Well, as you well know, I mean, in sight of land would be, in my opinion, on the radar. Now, you have definite contact of land. However, based on the waters I'm in, that could mean every half hour and be, quote, in sight of land, but it may be 48 miles away. If I was closer, like within 20 miles, I would expect to get a position every 20 minutes or so. In other words, as I got progressively closer, it would be my experience to take more and more fixes, more and more positions.
What would the definition of frequently be when you're within 3 to 4 miles of land?
I think I'd be pretty hot on the position. I would say that every five to 10 minutes would be every 5 minutes. If I was 3 miles off of a coast, every 5 to 10 minutes, let's say 10 minutes at the max.
What's the procedure for taking, logging, and plotting a radar fix? How would you go about doing it?
I'm not quite sure. What you want me to walk you through taking a radar fix?
Right. And how long does it take?
Well, that really would depend on the individual taking it. How long does it take me? I can get you a radar fix in 15 seconds. There was a time in my career where it might take me a minute and a half, because I'd be not completely sure of myself. But I would say, you know, you're asking me to hypothetically give you an average. You have a whole spectrum of experience in. Okay.
How long would it take you to take a bearing using the port bearing ring, a radar range, and then plot it?
If I was hopping, I could get it down within 10 to 20 seconds.
That includes going out the 33 steps to the port bridge wing to.
I've run out there before. You know, there's been occasions where I wanted it just like that.
What is your policy on watch concerning the changing to automatic steering from manual steering?
Normally, I do that myself. I do allow an AB to do it under my supervision. In other words, I'm standing right next to him when it happens. But I have never in my, I can never recall in my career ever allowing and AB to go from manual to gyro or from gyro to manual on his own without me being in right there next to him.
I have another exhibit here that I mentioned earlier. It's a 2-echo. There's a photographic reproduction of the course recorder. It's under attachment A.
This is live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board inquiry into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. James R. Kunkel, chief mate of the Exxon Valdez, is on the stand.
Attachment B is a expanded version of the same chart. I'd like to draw your attention to from about 0800 to 0830 Greenwich Mean Time. Would you describe the course?
Hold it a minute.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure this thing out. Okay. Go ahead, Commander. Let me try to get orientated. I've never seen this kind of expansion, and I'll have to try to figure it out here as rapidly as I can and still answer your question. But, okay, go ahead.
Would you prefer to work off the original one, or?
Well, I don't know.
The witness, James R. Kunkel, is being questioned by Commander Darrell Waldron, who's Marine Safety staff from the U.S. Coast Guard, and they're looking at charts of the recorders.
I'd like to draw your attention to the, again, to about 0800, and this is Greenwich Mean Time, to 0830. Period.
What zone were we on at that time? In other words, you're talking Greenwich time. This obviously has got to be the local time for me to have any knowledge of what we're talking about.
Okay. That would be 2300.
Okay, so 8 a.m. is 2300?
Correct.
Okay.
I'd like you to describe the course that was between 2300 and about 2330.
Looks like a very good course. Someone's holding the course quite well.
Would you describe the line there? Is it to vary by how much? 1 degree or half a degree?
Looks like anywhere from 1 to 1.5 degrees to my eyes.
Do you consider that to be a very good course for a vessel of this type and size?
Yeah, it looks to me like a pretty steady course.
Okay. Would you also look a little bit to the right there at about 2350 to 2400?
Okay.
How would you describe that course?
Looks like a very steady course. That would be
2350 to 2400. Okay, yeah.
How would you compare the?
It looks like within a 1 degree. It's a tough one because it's a short period of time. But during that short period of time, I would consider it to be just as good, if not better.
Okay, I would like for you to go to attachment B. You can see this is an expanded version of it. The squares are much larger. Do you feel comfortable describing the 2300 to 2330 course on this graph?
Okay.
Coast Guard Commander Daryl Waldrop has Chief Mate James Kunkel looking at the logs of the course records.
Also a very good course.
Would you also look at the 2350 to 2400 course? Compare the two.
The man we're hearing from,
yes,
Jim Kill.
On Appendix B, to help Mr. Kunkel, if he is a little confused, you're speaking of the 0845 to 0900.
Right.
The man we're hearing from, James Kunkel, is the chief mate of the Exxon Valdez. He was actually asleep at the time that the tanker ran aground and was wakened shortly. In fact, said he was awakened by the jolt of the tanker and has, right now, the line of questioning is following his evaluation of the course. If the line of questioning continues the way it did yesterday, what Commander Waldrop appears to be trying to assess is whether the ship appeared to be on autopilot and whether you can determine that, or what his assessment of that is, what Kunkel's assessment is that of that is, simply by looking at the records that are kept by an automatic recorder of the course of the Exxon Valdez.
The 2330 course.
A very steady course, just as good, maybe better.
Are you familiar with the two helmsmen that were operating at this time? The first one was Mr. Clare, and the second one was Mr. Kagan.
Okay.
Knowing their abilities, would you be able to determine which of these two courses were say, steered by Mr. Clare?
Well, I mean, you're asking me to answer this question if I was totally ignorant of what was going on. I mean, Mr. Clare was on this watch and Mr. Kagan was over here. I mean, I can't. You know, that can't be pulled out of my mind. I know who was on watch and who was steering. If you wanted me to tell you which one looks better, is that what you're trying to get at? I would assume that this course up here looks smoother. But that doesn't necessarily mean that this is a better quartermaster. It could very well be that the ship was steady at the time and there was no need for a rudder command at all. For a 10-minute period of time, 5-10 minute period of time, if the vessel's traveling at approximately, from the discussions I've heard, 12 knots, it's conceivable you could stand there and just watch the wheel for 5 minutes and the ship would continue on a straight course. So I can't really tell you that that's Mr. Kagan or Mr. Clare.
Could you determine by that straight course whether the vessel could have still been on autopilot?
Well, anything is possible, sir. But I personally, from my experience, cannot tell you by looking at this course that it is on automatic or that it is on hand.
Do you generally review the course recorder logs at any point?
Yes, I would normally take a look at the course steered. Yes, of course.
Okay. When you're underway at sea, most of the time you're on automatic pilot, is that correct?
That's correct.
What does the course line look on the recorder while you're on automatic pilot?
It would vary extensively on the weather. I mean, if we're a flat, calm sea with absolutely no current, no waves, no winds, it might be a smooth line. A minimal sea might be enough to make her hunt a little bit.
Okay. I have a question about the load program up. The only indication of a load program up in the material that we have is the log entry at 2352. The bell log doesn't indicate any change. Is there normally some type of recording device that records a change from a setting of full speed to a load program up?
You'll have to give me that one again.
Okay. Load program up was set at 2352.
Mm-hmm.
The only recording we have of that is in the log. Is there any change, or does someone have to do something to make the vessel go load program up? Is it the engineers, or is it done from the wheelhouse?
Normally, it would be done from the wheelhouse. You would call the engineer and inform him that you're ready to load program up.
Okay, and what do you do on the bridge to make the vessel come to load program up?
You have to push the button that says LPU.
Is that recorded in any of the mechanical devices that you went from full speed to load program up?
I'm not aware of it. You know, I know that you would record it in your logbook that you load programmed up. That's on the bridge. I'm not sure if that's recorded down in the engine room or on a printed copy somewhere.
Thank you.
You're listening to a live coverage of the NTSB hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez, brought to you by KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. On the stand is James R. Kunkel. He's being questioned by Coast Guard Commander Darrell Waldron.
12:30 or so. Was the did you notice that the vessel was still the engines were still ahead and that the maneuvering was taking place?
I can't really say I'm sure of that. When I went on the bridge, I'm really not sure what was going on with the navigational gear. I presented the master with my findings, and shortly thereafter, he told me to go back down below.
Okay, you're certainly aware that the engines were going. That's one of the noises that you're accustomed to hearing, that you knew that the vessel was still turning ahead. Is that correct?
No, I'm not sure about that. In other words, no one told me specifically the engines are going ahead. I know that they were going ahead from reading reports and things that you know have come out. But at that time, no one told me the engines were going ahead.
Was there any discussion about maneuvering the vessel to attempt to get it off the shoal?
Our original discussion was that the stress and everything, the stress and bending moments were exceeded, that the stability was still fine. There may have been a moment of time there, maybe 10 to 20 minutes, where, as you all call, getting off the rock may have taken place or may have been attempted. I do not know for sure. But by 0100, the information that I was giving the master would indicate to me that the vessel should stay where it was at.
Okay. On any of your trips to the bridge, did you attempt to ascertain the position of the vessel?
What do you mean by that, Commander?
Did you take a fix?
No, I did not. No.
Did you look at the radar?
I glanced at it, but I didn't take a fix or anything like that. The first thing I did was look in the radar to see where land was in case I had to get in a lifeboat and where it would be bearing.
And when you looked in the when you looked in the radar, did you notice any ice on the radar?
I did not look for ice. So, you know, in this period of time, I was not looking for ice. So I can't confirm that I did or did not see ice.
Did you notice any aids to navigation when you were out on deck or looking around? Did you?
Yes, I noticed the flashing buoy ahead. I'm not sure where it was now. But basically, I was not looking for aids to navigation, to be honest with you.
Did you see any ice in the water?
No, I did not.
Near the vessel?
No.
That night or the next, what about the next day or next days while you're still on the vessel?
I saw ice off in the distance on a couple days. The day we floated the vessel, I saw horrendous amounts of ice. Ice as big as half of this room from the top, from what I could see. That was the day that we left the area, and not being a Valdez sailor, I do recall some of the people who had been to Valdez a number of times saying it was the worst ice they'd ever seen. Okay.
I have some questions concerning alcohol or drug.